You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of, for the first time, of the Complete Collected Works, Volume 175, by Rudolf Steiner, titled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, Human Life in a Cosmic Context. The first seven lectures were around the concept of human life in a cosmic context, and now the last ten are the center of the book, Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, which begins with Lecture 8, translated by Simon Blaxland de Lange, given in Berlin on the 27th of March, 1917. At this time, I need to draw your attention again and again to one particular aspect of what our whole spiritual scientific research must focus upon at the present time. This has to do with the fact that behind the various concepts, ideas, and mental pictures that people form for themselves, and within which they live, there is not only what is generally referred to as logic, but also the world of reality, which must be sought by means of ideas that are deeply imbued with reality. In the course of these studies, which will be directed toward a particular aim that I shall characterize shortly, it may from time to time be necessary to indicate that it may easily happen that an idea or conception of some kind that has arisen in the course of life can be true in a certain way, but does not reach down to reality. It will only gradually become clear what is meant by ideas that are imbued with reality, but it will become possible to acquire a picture of this through some simple comparisons. Today I shall therefore introduce what I have in mind by means of a comparison or analogy. What I want to say now has apparently, but only apparently, no connection with our ensuing studies, but it is purely of an introductory nature. From the 16th century onward until 1839, all Roman cardinals had to make an important vow. During the years of his pontificate, Pope Sixtus V, who held office between 1585 and 1590, deposited a sum of 5 million scudi in the Castel San Angelo as a fund to be used only in time of need. Because it was considered so important that such a bounty should be available for such a purpose, cardinals always had to swear that they would carefully protect it. In the year 1839, under the pontificate of Pope Gregory XVI, Cardinal Acton raised an objection to this vow. He wanted the cardinals no longer to have to swear that they would preserve this treasure. If one were to hear nothing else about the story, one might form all sorts of excellent hypotheses as to why this remarkable Cardinal Acton did not want the cardinals to make the vow that was still required of them at this time, that they would guard the treasure that was of such potential importance to the Holy See. Moreover, everything that one would have to say could well be thoroughly logical. But all the very fine things that one might have ended up saying would be superseded by what Acton knew because of certain circumstances, and the cardinals did not know. He knew that since 1797, this fund had no longer been there, that it had been used for other purposes. So the cardinals had been required to swear that they would protect a treasure that was no longer there, and Acton did not want to demean himself by having to make a vow about something that no longer existed. So you see, all the ingenious discussions and hypotheses that someone would advance who did not know that the entire treasure had already been used up, all these hypotheses would collapse. If one meditates on an example such as this, and it may sometimes seem unnecessary to meditate about things that are so patently obvious, but one needs to do so in order to compare something of a matter-of-fact nature with many other situations in life, one may come to see the difference between ideas that are rooted in reality and those that are not. I need to make you aware of the unreality of ideas prevailing in our present time, for the simple reason that, as you will see later, and perhaps only on the next occasion that we meet, this is directly connected with the theme that I must speak about once more in the course of these lectures from the standpoint of spiritual science. My endeavor in this respect is to relate our previous studies to the consideration of a particular aspect of the Christ mystery. What I said last time will be able to serve as a framework for that aspect of the Christ mystery that we are now wanting to consider. Even though much of what I should like to present to you today may appear unrelated to our essential theme, it will nevertheless provide a valuable foundation. As you are aware, I tentatively began to indicate a particular way of approaching the Christ mystery in a book of mine which appeared quite some time ago, titled Christianity as Mystical Fact. This book, which was, incidentally, one of the last books to be confiscated in its new edition by the old regime in Russia a few weeks ago, is, I would say, a first attempt to understand Christianity itself from a spiritual point of view, a dimension which over the centuries has more or less disappeared in the development of Christianity in the West. I must first emphasize one thing in particular, upon which all the arguments in the book stand or fall. A particular view of the Gospels is presented in title Christianity as Mystical Fact. I do not want to say any more about this here, as you can read about it in the book. However, if there is any justification for this view, it is necessary to assume that the Gospels did not arise as late as Christian theologians often suppose today, but that their origin must be placed somewhat earlier. You are aware that, according to this view, the elements of the Gospel teaching are to be found in the ancient texts of the mysteries, and that the mystery of Golgotha is a fulfillment of what is contained in these texts. If one advocates such a spiritual conception of Christianity at the present time, one finds oneself at odds with a great deal of theological and historical research, and contemporary theologians in particular will tend to regard such a conception as historically without foundation. It is thought to be fairly clear that in the first century, or at any rate in the first two-thirds of the first century, the Gospels did not play any particular part. There are even Christian theologians who doubt whether there is any evidence that in the first century of the Christian era, people of consequence thought of, or more to the point, believed in, the person of Christ Jesus. Now it will become increasingly apparent that if the seemingly so careful research of the present day would but expand its horizons and become not merely precise but also much broader in its scope, many of its reservations will fall away. One can, of course, draw all sorts of conclusions today from questions arising from, for example, certain contradictions between Christian and Jewish records. But these conclusions fail to acknowledge that the apocryphal Gospels, that is to say, those records not officially recognized as Christian, are very little known and are virtually ignored, especially by Christian theologians. A large part of this lack of recognition derives from the fact that Christianity, and specifically the mystery of Golgotha, has not been understood in a sufficiently spiritual way, and that no relationship has been formed with the Pauline distinction between the soul and the spiritual aspects of man's being. Just consider our very simple division of man into body, soul, and spirit. The fact is that Paul, who was familiar with the atavistic nature of the truths of the ancient mysteries, envisaged with his distinction between the psychic and the spiritual aspects of man something very similar to what we mean when we speak of the soul and the spirit as two parts of human nature. But it is precisely this distinction between psyche and pneuma, or between soul and spirit, that has, more or less, completely disappeared in the West. However, it is not possible to understand the real nature of the mystery of Golgotha without some concept of man's spiritual nature as distinct from his soul. I should like, first of all, to refer to something that I have already mentioned in previous years, something that can show you that there is much in the received historical record that is actually incorrect, especially as regards recent research into the life of Jesus. As I have said, the conventional view is that the Gospels came into being relatively late. This can be challenged on purely historical grounds. It can, for example, be countered by the fact that in the year A.D. 70, the Rabbi Gamaliel II was involved in a legal case. He was the son of Rabbi Simeon, who was the son of that Gamaliel of whom Paul was a pupil. And the aforesaid Gamaliel II had a sister with whom he was involved in a lawsuit over inheritance. They were led before the judge, who was a Roman, and perhaps also a Jew, although that is difficult to confirm, sympathetic to Christianity. Gamaliel pleaded that he was the sole heir, because according to Mosaic law, daughters cannot inherit. The judge raised the objection, quote, "Since you Jews have lost your country, the law, Torah, of Moses is no longer valid. What matters now is the gospel, and according to the gospel, a sister can also inherit." Close quote. There was at first no straightforward solution. So what happened? Gamaliel II, who was not only keen to acquire his inheritance, but also cunning, requested an adjournment of the case, which was granted. In the course of the adjournment, he stood before the judge whom he had bribed, who now gave a different verdict, and said that he had made a mistake at the original hearing. The gospel was indeed applicable to such cases, but in the gospel it states that Mosaic law, the Torah of Moses, is not annulled by the gospel. As confirmation of this, he quoted the verse in St. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5, verse 17, that relates to this in the version that we have today, of course, with the minor differences between the Greek language and the language in which the gospel was written when the judge's verdict was given in A.D. 70. In his ruling, the judge simply referred to St. Matthew's Gospel, while the Talmud, where this story is related, accepts this statement from St. Matthew's Gospel without question. Through a broadening of the scope of research, even of a purely historical nature, much could therefore be adduced to show that one does not stand on solid ground if one refuses to assign an early date to the origin of the Gospels. Historical research will one day fully confirm the research emanating from completely different spiritual sources, which forms the foundation of my book, Christianity as Mystical Fact. Now, everything that has a relationship to the mystery of Golgotha has within it very deep mysteries, which can be penetrated if spiritual scientific faculties of perception are developed to an increasing degree. There is much to indicate that these questions are not as simple as people very often imagine them to be today. Thus, for example, little attention is paid to the relationship of Judaism to the way that Christ Jesus was perceived in the first century of our era. There are theologians who study certain Jewish writings in order to find evidence for their various theories. However, one can easily demonstrate that these Jewish writings, on which so much reliance is placed, did not exist in the first century A.D. One thing does, nevertheless, seem to be very clear historically, namely, that in the first century, and especially in the second, third of that century, there was a relatively good relationship between Judaism and Christianity, if one can use this word in the context of the period concerned, and that it frequently happened that when certain enlightened Jews of that time entered into discussions with followers of Christ Jesus, it was not so very difficult to reach an agreement. One needs only to recall such instances as the following, when the famous Rabbi Eliezer became acquainted around the middle of the first century with a certain Jacob, as he calls him, who acknowledged himself to be a pupil of Jesus, and who healed in his name. The famous Rabbi Eliezer conversed with this Jacob, and said in the course of the conversation that there was absolutely nothing against the true spirit of Judaism in what he had said, or quite especially, in that he healed the sick in the name of Jesus. One can then see that this more or less easy harmony that existed in this earlier period disappeared toward the end of the first century, that, in other words, even enlightened Jews became fierce opponents, implacable enemies of everything of a Christian nature. It also happened that when the Jewish texts that are considered to be important today were composed in the second century A.D., an altogether different mood with respect to Christianity entered into their composition than was the case within Judaism in the first century. One can witness the development of a hatred for Christianity growing from decade to decade, especially within Judaism. This went hand in hand with the transformation of Judaism itself. Although modern Jewish scholars do, of course, know the Old Testament in their own way, they do not know what was still living within Judaism in other respects at the time of the mystery of Golgotha. And they are also largely unaware of the major issues with which a truly historical investigation of this period is concerned. It is necessary to realize that the Old Testament was read completely differently in the first century A.D. from the way that the most learned Jewish rabbis can read it today. Especially since the 19th century, the capacity to interpret ancient texts has more or less disappeared. Certain things which even in the 18th century still existed as a secret tradition in the form of truths derived from old atavistic clairvoyance could no longer be imagined by people in the 19th century, and the only conception that people have of them today is that those who speak about them, even if they belong to an earlier time, must be a bit crazy. In the previous lecture, I drew your attention to an important book called Des Erreurs et de la Vérité by St. Martin. This book is undoubtedly a late example of its kind, inasmuch as it contains insights deriving from ancient traditions, which have now become veiled in obscurity, while, nevertheless, faithfully reflecting these traditions. I have recently quoted extracts from this book, which people today would understand only with the greatest difficulty. But if we allow ourselves to be guided by St. Martin's views, we shall see that he was expressing thoughts which a modern person would either regard as pure fantasy, and virtually everything of this nature is regarded as such today, or considered to be utterly absurd. St. Martin indicates that the human race as it is now has fallen into its present condition from primeval heights. Many people today, who have not become wedded to the materialistic conception of the world, are willing to tolerate the idea that the present human race can be traced back to former times when, with a part of its being, as it were, it was at a higher level. Despite the materialistic character of Darwinism, which assumes that man has evolved purely from animals, there are other people who are of the opinion that man descended from a lofty origin of some kind, where he was inspired by ancient traditions of a divine nature. But when one goes beyond such an abstract picture and approaches the sort of concrete assertions that St. Martin makes, and which he can only make because these assertions are associated with ancient traditions from the primeval epoch of clairvoyance, it is beyond the wit of modern man to make anything of such things. How is a person of today, who knows his chemistry, his geology, his biology, physiology, and so on with absolute thoroughness, and who has also assimilated that strange artifact that goes by the name of philosophy nowadays, how is such a person to respond when St. Martin says that the human race became as it is now only after the fall, and that it was originally very different? In those former times, a man had a certain kind of impenetrable armor, which he has now lost. It originally formed part of his organism, and had enabled him to withstand the struggles that he had to endure in these ancient times. It was also armed with a lance of bronze, which could inflict wounds in the way that fire does. And with this lance, he was able to be equal to the battle against beings of a different nature to human beings, which faced him at that time. And in the place where he originally dwelt, he had 7 trees at his disposal. Each of these trees had 16 roots and 490 branches. He then left this place and fell from these lofty origins. I doubt that one would be thought of as being in one's right mind if one were to do what Saint Simon undoubtedly did, namely to insist that his views were no less real than the beautiful constructions that geologists form about primeval times. If one were to come up with abstract allegories or symbols, this would make it all a bit more acceptable. But Saint Martin was not speaking symbolically. He was speaking of realities that had really existed. It was, of course, necessary for St. Martin to choose imaginative pictures for certain things that existed when the earth, in its primal state, was more spiritual than in later times. However, such imaginative pictures represent realities. They should not be interpreted symbolically, but must be accepted in the imaginative form in which they are presented. I wanted to mention this, not in order to enter deeply into this theme, but merely to show you how fundamentally different the language of the 18th century, the language in which a book such as Des Erreurs et de la Vérité is written, was from the language that is now regarded as the only one that passes muster today. The kind of writing that one still finds in St. Martin has completely died out. But as the Old Testament, for example, can only be read in its full depth if one is either still or is again possessed of certain knowledge associated with imaginative perceptions, you can understand that by the time of the 19th century in particular, it had become impossible to read the Old Testament with any real understanding. But the further back one goes, the more does one find that at the time when the mystery of Golgotha took place, the world of Judaism encompassed not only the exoteric documents of the Old Testament, but also an esoteric teaching, a true mystery wisdom. And it was an important aspect of this mystery wisdom that it gave one the possibility of reading the Old Testament in the right way. It is simply not possible to read the Testament in the right way unless one views what it says against a background of spiritual realities. At the time of the mystery of Golgotha, the strongest aversion to the particular qualities of Jewish occult teachings derived from Rome. Indeed, one might say that there has possibly never in the whole of earthly evolution been a greater contrast than that between the spirit of Rome and the mystery wisdom guarded by the initiates in Palestine. One should, of course, not simply view this mystery wisdom in the way that it lived at that time in Palestine, for one would not find Christianity in it, but only a kind of prophetic anticipation of it. On the other hand, however, One can only comprehend what was fermenting within Christianity if one views it against the historical background of the mystery teaching living in Palestine. This mystery teaching was full of hidden knowledge about the spiritual being of man. It was full of indications for a path of human cognition extending into the spiritual world. Ramifications of what lived in this occult teaching were also to be found in the Greek mysteries. There was, however, little trace of it in the Roman mysteries. Rome had no place for the dynamic thrust that underlay the Palestinian mysteries, for it had developed a particular kind of human community, a particular form of social life, which could exist only if one disregarded the spiritual dimension of man's being. The essential quality of Roman history was that a human community was to be established which would more or less exclude man as a spiritual being. A society was to be brought into being where it would be meaningless to speak of man as a threefold being with a body, soul, and spirit. The further back one goes into history, the more one realizes that the way that the mystery of Golgotha was understood in ancient times was based on this division of the totality of man's being into body, soul, and spirit, just as Paul still spoke consistently of psyche and pneuma, of the soul and the spirit. But this was highly offensive to all the sensibilities that were natural to Romans, and this was the reason for much that happened subsequently. As you are aware, that body of wisdom which can no longer be applied today, but at the time in question sought to rescue the threefold picture of man and the cosmos, was Gnosticism. In later centuries, it was more or less completely eliminated and repressed, with the result that it totally disappeared. I am certainly not suggesting that it ought to have survived. I wish merely to state the historical fact that Gnosticism still had a spiritual conception of the mystery of Golgotha and was repressed. Events now developed in a very strange way, for what happened was that Christianity increasingly became part of the Roman world. But this process of increasing amalgamation was not matched by any understanding on the part of the Roman world for the relationship of Christianity to the spiritual aspect of man's being. It gave more and more offense that some Gnostic Christians continued to speak of body, soul, and spirit. In those circles where Christianity had become the official religion, there were increasing efforts to suppress the spirit, the very idea of the spirit. People felt that one should not make any reference to the spirit, for it was thought that this could lead to all the old ideas of a division of man into body, soul, and spirit reviving once more. Historical development continued along these lines. If we make an exact study of the early Christian centuries, we find that much that is generally explained in a different way is seen in its true light if one becomes aware that it was increasingly the aim of the growing Roman character of Christianity to cause the idea of the Spirit to disappear altogether. Innumerable questions of conscience and epistemology can be seen for what they are only if one becomes truly aware of this need of European-led Christianity to get rid of the Spirit. This development eventually led to a formula or dogma being laid down at the Eighth Ecumenical Council of 869 in Constantinople, which, while not being so explicit in its wording, was later interpreted as meaning that it is contrary to Christianity to speak of body, soul, and spirit, and that the only true Christian thing to say is that man consists of a body and a soul. The Eighth Ecumenical Council initially stated that man had an intellectual soul and a spiritual soul. This formula was phrased in such a way as to avoid having to speak of the spirit as a distinct entity. Nevertheless, it amounted to an ousting of all knowledge of the Spirit. There is much connected with this of which people are unaware. Our modern philosophers embark on their studies in such a way that they investigate the body on the one hand and the soul on the other. If you were to ask these people, for example, Wundt or others like him, what is the basis for making this distinction, they would of course affirm that it rests on purely factual foundations, on the actual observation that it makes no sense to speak of body, soul, and spirit, but only of a body that is related to the outside world, and a soul that is related to one's inner world. Someone such as Wundt would say that this is perfectly obvious. He has no idea that all this is the consequence of what the Eighth Ecumenical Council had decreed. Even today, modern philosophers do not speak about the Spirit, but they follow the dogma of the Eighth Ecumenical Council. Precisely why, even though not explicitly, modern philosophers deny the Spirit, they have no more idea than the Roman cardinals knew what they were actually swearing when they made the vow to protect a fund that no longer existed. People generally tend to pay very little attention to the truly seminal aspects of history, the real forces underlying it. Thus, anyone who rejects the view of unprejudiced or objective science, as it is called, that man consists only of a body and a soul, may well be regarded as an ignoramus, simply because those who perpetuate this, in quotes, objective science, are unaware that their assumptions are based on the decrees of the Eighth Ecumenical Council in 869. And so it is with many other things. It is fair to say that this Eighth Council is an important window through which one can gain insight into a good part of the evolution of Western thought. You are aware that a deep rift runs through the cultural development of the West with respect to the schism between those different forms of religious worship which live on today in, respectively, the Russian Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church, or have evolved from them. From a purely doctrinal point of view, and there are, of course, many more far-reaching impulses lying behind the actual dogmas themselves, the difference between them revolves, as you know, around the famous filioque clause. According to the later council, the Russian Church recognizes only the first seven councils. The Roman Catholic Church recognizes the wording that states that the Holy Spirit proceeds, quote, from the Father and the Son, close quote. Not only from the Father, but also from the Son. This was declared heretical by Constantinople, that is, the Eastern Church. For the Russian Church, as has been said, many deeper impulses lie behind these doctrinal issues, but it is enough for today merely to state that this is so. Recognizes that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father. The great confusion with respect to this dogma could only arise because there was a general confusion about the notion of the Spirit, in that the very idea of the Spirit was gradually becoming completely lost. This is undoubtedly connected with the fact that as the fifth post-Atlantean cultural period approached, man had for a while to be denied all perception of the Spirit. Compared with this underlying truth, what actually took place is, I would say, merely a surface reflection. But it is necessary to penetrate beyond this reflection if one wants to arrive at a valid point of view that is rooted in reality. Now, the period of evolution which played an important part in the establishment of this dogma that there is no spirit, that man consists only of a body and a soul, has not come to an end. The Christian theologians of the Middle Ages, who still lived in the midst of ongoing traditions, for it was only Orthodox Church doctrine that maintained that man consists of a body and a soul, whereas alchemists and those other people who still had confidence in the old traditions knew perfectly well that man has a body, a soul, and a spirit, knew how difficult it was to hold orthodox opinions, on the one hand, while on the other to have to acknowledge that behind the heretical teachings of body, soul, and spirit, which surrounded them everywhere, a kernel of truth lay hidden. We see everywhere Christian theologians making frantic but vain attempts to avoid what they referred to as the trichotomy, the division of man into three parts. Anyone who does not make himself aware of the difficulties that theologians had in avoiding the trichotomy can have no real understanding of medieval Christian theology. Indeed, this evolutionary period has not finished by a long way, for it corresponds to a very important impulse in the cultural development of the West. And because so much will take place in the 20th century that one will need to be aware of if one wants to understand our present age, I shall need to speak further about this century. Originally, if what has come about in relatively recent times may be referred to in this way, man was divided into body, soul, and spirit. Evolution had advanced to the point that by the 9th century the spirit could be abolished. But matters did not rest there. People do not follow these processes properly today because they fail to consider important matters such as the complete transformation of thinking by St. Martin, to mention one example. Things proceed further. And not only is the spirit being abolished, but there is a growing tendency toward abolishing the soul. Hitherto, only certain preliminary steps have been taken in this direction. The time is now ripe for the abolition of the soul as well. But people fail to recognize these important tendencies that are living among us now. We are already witnessing powerful evolutionary impulses that are preparing for the abolition of the soul. It is not a matter of organizing councils, as in the 9th century, for things to take a different course today. I must repeat that I am not criticizing these phenomena, but am merely making you aware of certain facts. There is evidence for the preliminary stages in abolishing the soul in all manner of different areas. Thus, in the 19th century, there emerged dialectical materialism, which has become the view of history that underlies modern German social democracy. If you regard Engels and Marx as the major prophets, in quotes, it might perhaps be regarded as inappropriate to use such a traditional word, but it may suffice for our present purposes, of dialectical materialism. They are also the direct descendants, in historical terms, of the Church Fathers of the 8th Ecumenical Council. There is an unbroken line of development between the two. What the Church Fathers set in motion by abolishing the spirit has been carried forward by Marx and Engels in their already well-advanced plans to abolish the soul. After all, according to this view, soul or inner impulses will no longer be of any significance. For the sole driving forces of history are material impulses, the struggle for material possessions. Moreover, the soul is conceived of as being merely a superstructure, added to the solid foundation of a purely material process. But it is really important to recognize the true Catholic nature of Marx and Engels. For it is essential that one views these aspirations of the 19th century as the next step in the development of what occurred in connection with the abolition of the spirit. The development of the modern scientific outlook is another factor contributing to the abolition of the soul. The scientific view of the world, I am referring not to experimental science itself, but to the theories which attribute reality only to physical phenomena, and regard everything of a soul nature merely as an illusion, as something that has no existence independent of our corporeal nature, is a direct continuation of those developments that we have perceived in the important impulses enshrined in the 8th Ecumenical Council. However, a large part of humanity will probably not take this seriously until the abolition of the soul will acquire legal force from certain focal points of earthly evolution. It will not be long before laws are drafted in a number of countries which will lead to anyone speaking in all seriousness about a soul being declared as not in his right mind, while the only people who are regarded as sane will be those who recognize the, in quotes, truth, that thinking, feeling, and will arise from certain bodily functions out of pure necessity. Various steps have already been taken in this direction, but so long as these initial steps are only of a theoretical nature, they will not have any great, deeply influential effect or significance. This will only happen when they become part of the social order, of social life in general. The first half of this century will barely be over before something happens in this realm, which for someone with a requisite insight will be a terrible spectacle, a desolation in the soul realm, akin to that which afflicted the spirit in the 9th century. It is worth saying again and again that what matters is to have insight into such things, insight into the impulses that have governed human life over the course of history. For it all too easily happens that through their education, which is governed by a purely materialistic view of the world, people in the present time have a tendency toward a soporific state of being. The materialistic worldview, to a certain extent, prevents a person from thinking properly, from perceiving reality in a really healthy way, lulls them to sleep when it comes to the important aspects of historical developments. And so even those who have a real longing to follow a path of spiritual knowledge do not have the strength of will to kindle an awareness of certain impulses that are inherent in our evolution, and to make a real effort to perceive things as they really are. Thus there was in Palestine a kind of occult teaching which was a preparation for the mystery of Golgotha, a teaching with respect to which the mystery of Golgotha represented a fulfillment. I have expressed this by saying that the mystery of Golgotha was the greatest mystery ever to have been enacted on the stage of world history. If this is so, one can pose the question as to why such a strong antipathy developed in the Roman world to what emerged through the mystery of Golgotha in the form of Christianity, and why this antipathy led specifically to the abolition of the spirit. These things are far more closely related than one might think, if one merely looks at them superficially. Few people today would want to consider the idea that Marx and Engels are like church fathers, though this does not represent the full truth of the matter. One begins to understand it at a deeper level if one considers the following. At the court of justice, where Christ Jesus was condemned, those referred to as the Sadducees played a leading part. What was their role when the mystery of Golgotha took place? Who were the people who have rightly been called the Sadducees? They were those who wanted to make everything deriving from the mysteries vanish away, disappear into oblivion. The Sadducees had a fear, a terror, an absolute dread of any form of mystery cult. But they were also the people who had responsibility for the courts and likewise for the administration in Palestine. They were, however, wholly under the influence of the Roman state. Indeed, they were the slaves of the Roman state, as was outwardly apparent, that they purchased their positions with enormous sums of money, and then in turn extracted vast amounts of money from the population of Palestine. It was they who, because of the way that their Ahrimanic materialism had sharpened their perception, were particularly aware that the Roman world would be seriously threatened if the notion that everything associated with Christ was in harmony with the essence of the mysteries came to be generally accepted. They had an instinctive sense that something was flowing from Christianity which would gradually overthrow the authority of Rome. This is also the real reason why in the course of the first century, and also in later centuries, those terrible wars of extermination, which really were quite terrible, were waged with the underlying idea that once the Jews were slaughtered, all those who knew something of the reality and traditions of the mysteries would also be eradicated. Everything related to the mysteries, specifically in Palestine, was to be wiped out root and branch. This process of eradication also strongly entailed creating a barrier, a wall, that made it virtually impossible to perceive the spiritual aspect of man's being or to find a path to it. It would have been dangerous for those who later sought to abolish the spirit on behalf of Rome, of Roman Christendom, if many of those from the ancient mystery schools of Palestine, who still knew something about the paths to the spirit, those who could still have borne witness to the fact that man consists of body, soul, and spirit, had still survived. For the impulse of the Roman world was that an outward social order had to be established where the spirit had no place. A stream of development was to be introduced that would exclude all spiritual impulses. This would not have happened if too many people had known something about the interpretation of the mystery of Golgotha that lived in the mysteries. It was instinctively felt that what was to evolve out of the Roman state could have nothing of a spiritual nature. The church and the Roman state entered into a marriage, and from this union jurisprudence in particular was born. In all this, the spirit was not allowed to utter a word. This was important. However, it is equally important that it is seen that we are now living at a time when the spirit must again be invoked. It must be summoned so that it may participate in human affairs. You can imagine how difficult this will be, since things have fallen to so deep a level. I believe that it will be a long time before it is recognized that the materialistic interpretation of history is a true continuation of the Eighth Ecumenical Council. I also believe that it will be a long time before people understand what lies in the few letters that distinguish the Eastern aspect of European Christianity from the Western aspect. It is sufficient today to speak about these matters in a superficial way and to pass only superficial judgments. Much will have to live on the level of feelings, and feelings can be a reliable guide if one thing is borne in mind. The feeling to which I refer and with which I shall conclude for today is as follows. If one studies the history of Europe since the emergence of Christianity and is not satisfied with that fable convenue which is the travesty of history that is taught today and is the hidden cause of so much mischief, if one has a sense for the real study of history and has the courage to reject with sufficient strength that awful parody of history that passes for history today, one will, specifically in connection with the development of Christianity, arrive at a feeling which can be a leitmotif, a guiding principle, in one's endeavor to understand the present. One finds that nothing has met with so many obstacles, so much incomprehension and misrepresentation as the development of Christianity. And nothing has been so difficult as the fact that Christianity has spread. A further feeling that arises from this is that if one is speaking of miracles, there is no greater miracle than that Christianity has survived, that it exists. But it does not merely exist, for we live today at a time when Christianity will have to prevail, not only against the abolition of the spirit, but also against the abolition of the soul. And yet it will indeed prevail. Christianity will develop its greatest power precisely at the time of the greatest opposition. And through the resistance that must be developed against the abolition of the soul, the strength will also be found to recognize the spirit once more. When out of the spirit, please forgive the inappropriate use of the word in this context, that rules our present age, laws will be promulgated whereby those people who regard the soul as a reality will be declared as not being in their right mind. Of course, the laws will not specifically state that someone who recognizes the existence of the soul will be declared as not being in his right mind, but laws of this nature will nevertheless be enacted under the brutal impact of the scientific worldview. When, that is, this modern metamorphosis of the Eighth Ecumenical Council manifests itself, the time will have come to restore the spirit to its rightful place. We shall then have to recognize that vague ideas are of no use unless one is aware of the deeper sources, the deep-seated feelings underlying these nebulous concepts. For behind such concepts is often hidden what modern man is most unwilling to acknowledge, but to which has nevertheless succumbed. It is because he does not want to admit this and does not recognize it openly that it is manifested in his thinking as a punishment. Nevertheless, as St. Martin says in the more important passages in his book, quote, "these things cannot be spoken of." Close quote. It is true that there are certain things that it will not be possible to speak about for a long time. But many things would have to be inscribed on stone tablets if people are to be made aware of what is actually going on. And in a not too distant future, such a clear inscription will make manifest the hidden tendencies whence the materialistic interpretation of Darwinism has arisen, the perverse, sense-bound tendencies out of which the materialistically oriented theory of Darwinism has sprung. However, I do not want to depress your spirits with something that could well disturb your sleep. So I shall continue in this vein, but I shall not continue in this vein, but simply allow you to ponder these questions. The next time we meet, I shall try to present a framework for the building stones that I wanted to lay down as a foundation for a special study of the mystery of Golgotha. The end of Lecture 8.